Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. We are about to have a conversation with Dr. Tom Katena. Dr. Tom Katena works in Sudan's Nuba Mountains, in the middle of a war zone. The stories that are just mind-boggling and incredible. Many of us have heard the stories we've done in the past on Sudan, on both the young people in Khartoum who are resisting the regime, people who were in southern Sudan during the war, and others. Tom Katena is here with us in the States now before he heads back to the Nuba Mountains, where he runs a hospital and is pretty much the only surgeon in that hospital. And Tom Katena, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks very much. Great to be here.
Tom, tell us, first of all, let's take a little background. Both your background and the one on the what's happening in the Nuba Mountains. You were a Navy physician, right?
Yes, correct.
And then after you finished with your service to the United States Navy, something drove you to become a physician in the developing world, and that also drew you to Sudan.
Yep.
Tell us that story.
Well, ever since college, I'd wanted to do some kind of a missionary work, meaning, you know, trying to serve Christ through working with the poor. And I'd always been attracted to Africa. I studied engineering in college. I graduated from Brown University back in 1986. And when I was graduating, there weren't any real jobs in that mission field that were amenable to working as a mechanical engineer. So I decided at that point to go into medicine. With the eventual goal of working with the poor and the underserved. So from that point, so I go to medicine, ended up going to medical school at Duke. And when I was at Duke, I had a Navy scholarship, so I had to fulfill my obligation to the Navy after finishing medical school. And after medical school and after medical school in the Navy, was a flight surgeon there for about 5 years. After that, I was free of my Navy obligation. I decided to do family practice because I thought that would be the best match for working in the mission field and working in these isolated regions. So I went on to residency and family practice in Indiana. And after that, was free to do what I wanted to do. And ended up going to Africa, working with mission hospitals. I've been there since January 2000 until now.
So how did you end up in Sudan?
When I was working in Kenya, I was in Kenya for 8 years. About the second or third year I was there, I met another American surgeon that was working in Kenya. She was there just for a short-term thing, just for a couple months. I was there, of course, long-term. And she told me, well, she knows this bishop who runs a diocese in Sudan, and he's building a hospital there. And this American surgeon thought that I might want to work with him, thought I'd be a good match for this hospital. So she encouraged me to get in touch with them. She also wrote to the bishop to look at, I know there's an American doctor that I think would be a good match for your hospital in Sudan. At the time, the hospital wasn't built yet. It was back in 2002. So I eventually ended up working in Nairobi. And when I was in Nairobi, this diocese has an office there. It's kind of a long story, but the bishop of that diocese in Sudan was living in exile in Kenya because he had life threat. He had death threats against him. The Khartoum government was going to kill him back in the 1990s. So he fled. He fled Sudan. Ended up setting up sort of a diocese in exile in Nairobi and ran the diocese from there. So when I was working there in Nairobi, I met up with him and the other people in the diocese office. And I said, look, when you guys open the hospital, I'm your man. I'll come work with you. And they were happy to have somebody. And then finally when the construction was finished in 2008, I was in touch with them over the years. It was okay. You know, we're hospital's finished. Let's get started. So went in March 10th, 2008, flew in, and we got everything set up, moved all the beds in, got the operating room set up, the lab, the pharmacy, everything, and started seeing patients, started doing operations almost immediately back in March 2008. We've been going since then.
So you worked in the Nuba Mountains during the Civil War, when the Southern Sudanese rebels were fighting the Sudanese government for more freedom and independence.
We went actually after the peace agreement was signed in 2005. So we started when I first went to Nuba Mountains, which was 2008. The original 25-year civil war had been over for about 3 years at that point, 2 or 3 years. And we were sort of in this interim period of peace. The Nuba Mountains is kind of a separate area. We're not part of South Sudan, so we were considered a jointly administered area. So all the civil infrastructure in the mountains and different sectors were sort of jointly operated by SPLA, which is the old Southern forces, and the Northern government, the National Congress Party. So during this time, initially, there was more or less peace there. I mean, there's always tension and problems, but for the most part, it was fairly peaceful. The problem in Nuba is that it was kind of a, during the peace agreement, they were kind of left out in the cold. The peace agreement said, well, you know, in 2011, there'll be a referendum. January 2011, we'll have a referendum. Southerners can decide whether they want to stay a part of one union or they want to separate from the North. The Nuba Mountains area was not given that right for referendum. They were told that they could have what's called a popular consultation, sort of a separate process, which would grant them some level of autonomy, but not the same as having a direct referendum. And I mean, as things turned out, the South voted January 2000 to separate, or January 2011 to separate. They separated. In the mountains, we had gubernatorial elections, May 2011, and this public consultation was supposed to follow after the elections. Unfortunately, the war started again. The war was just confined to the mountains now. The fighting in the mountains started in June 2011. This public consultation never took place, so the people never had their chance for self-determination.
So, your experience in the Nuban Mountains. I mean, you're here. You're the in part to kind of raise awareness and money for the hospital you work in the Nuban Mountains. Talk about the people there, who they are, and what you've experienced both as a surgeon in the hospital.
Well, the Nuba are an African sort of collective. They're a collection of different Nuba tribes. There are 50 different sub-tribes amongst the Nuba. They live in central Sudan, and they're right on the border of the Arab and African worlds. Literally just north of the Nuba Mountains, you have the Arab world. Immediately south, you have the Dinka and the African world. So they are African people, and they are the right on the border of the two worlds. There's different theories as to how they ended up there in the Nuba Mountains. The thought is that they were sort of chased down the Nuba Mountains by marauding Arabs, you know, a millennia ago. They were chased out of northern Sudan and southern Egypt, chased south by these marauding Arabs, and they sought refuge in the Nuba Mountains. They stayed there ever since. There are 50 different sub-tribes, and collectively they're known as Nuba. So each of those sub-tribes has their own language. For instance, where we are is one language group. If you travel literally 6 miles across the mountain, there's a totally different language group. And these people cannot communicate in their native languages. They have to speak either Arabic or English to understand each other. So the Nuba are sort of very independent-minded. They're very strong people. In general, they're very gentle people. They're not being terrorized by the North. They're sort of, the general disposition is very gentle. They're a mixture. They're, you know, they're both maybe 50-60% are Muslim, maybe 30-40% are Christian, several which have traditional beliefs. They're mixed religions, but traditionally they've gotten along well. There's been no conflict between Muslim and Christian amongst the Nuba. They've been pretty much subjugated and marginalized by the Arab regime in Khartoum for a long time, certainly before they got independence in the 50s. But since independence, they've been marginalized by the Arab elite who are ruling the country from Khartoum. And this conflict now is sort of an ongoing conflict from the previous civil war, fighting against this idea of marginalization and discrimination. They want some measure of self-determination. That's the reason for the current problem. Our immediate area, they're farmers. 99.99% are subsistence farmers. They have small farms. They grow sorghum, peanuts. They have a few small animals, you know, a few cows, a few goats, but primarily farmers. Very few are educated. The illiteracy rate is probably, I would guess, around 80-90%. Very few can read and write. The vernacular there is mostly Arabic. A few speak English, but they kind of communicate. The tribes can communicate with each other through Arabic, as they can't understand each native language. Each tribal language is not understandable by other tribes.
So your work, I mean, one of the things that you describe here is the constant attacks that are taking place from the North on the right. Nubians on in the Nuba Mountains, the Nuba people, and right. And what you experience daily.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, the fighting for us, the conflict started back in June 2011, and you know, the initial fights were between the soldiers that were sort of left over, the SPLA soldiers that were stationed in the mountains fighting against the northern soldiers. So initially we got a lot of soldiers and casualties. And from the outset, we received a lot of civilian casualties. Most of the civilians, initially they were civilians who were caught in the crossfire, came with bullet wounds and shrapnel wounds. Since that time, most of the civilian casualties have been victims of these aerial bombardments. So what the Khartoum government does, they'll come in, they'll bomb an area, to use these old planes called Antonovs. Antonov is really a transport plane. It's got a two-engine propeller plane. It's mostly a transport plane, but they've rigged these things so they can drop bombs out of them. Yeah, it's kind of a primitive weapon. Basically, what they do is they fly over an area, and they basically roll these big barrel bombs out the back of the airplane and drop indiscriminately. They often will target civilian areas. They don't necessarily target military areas because their bombs are not very accurate. They will bomb civilian targets, knowing that the effect will be to terrorize those civilians. They want to drive the people off their land. They want to drive them either up into the mountainsides where they have living caves. They want to drive them off their land so they can't cultivate. That will eventually starve people out. They want to drive them down at the refugee camp down in Ida, so that with the eventual goal of kind of moving in their own Arab tribes into the mountains to take the land over. We've had a lot of these casualties from the Arab bombardments. I mean, since I've been home on leave, I got an email today from the doctor who's taking my place, or from the anesthetist down there. They just got somebody who was another victim of a bombardment. This was yesterday, I think. They were bombed in Kauda, which is about 6 miles away from us, and the lady had a traumatic amputation of her leg, was hit the abdomen. They had an amputation. The patient's doing fine. So this is something that we experience all the time. It's become normal. Have these people come in that are maimed by these bombs. These are often women, sometimes old women. Sometimes you have ladies in their 70s being hit with these. A lot of children have been injured. And there's never any military objective when they do these bombardments.
And the situation that the Nubians find themselves in, I mean, if the war in some ways has been settled, even though there's still troops massing on the border and there's issues of minerals and more that northern Sudan wants to make sure it has a hold of, and other issues as well around that make this tension still exist. Why is the Sudanese government still bombing the Nubian mountains? Why are they still killing the Nuba people?
Well, the only thing we can think of is that they're, you know, in some respects, it's simply a racial issue, where the government is a racist regime. I mean,
what do you mean?
I'm not saying that flippantly because if you go back to the 1990s, in the 1990s there was jihad against the Nuba, signed off by imams in the north. This was promulgated by Hassan al-Farabi, who was still a political figure in Khartoum. He used to be a friend of the president, Omar Bashir. Now they've had a falling out. But there was a real jihad pronounced against the Nuba. And the reason they could do jihad was because you had Christians there that they could kill, but also they were Muslims that practiced apostasy because they kept pigs and they drank some alcohol. The Muslims were not good Muslims. So they could kill them. And, of course, there were Christians and other non-believers they could target. So there's a history of jihad against these people. And it's primarily an Arab, it's an ethnic thing where it's primarily Arab against the Africans. It's very similar to what's happening in Darfur. With Darfur, the ones that are being subjugated are the African tribes of Darfur, subjugated by Arabs or their Arab proxy armies, which are Arab militias.
But in Darfur, most of those people who were being killed in Darfur by the Sudanese and others are Muslims.
Right, they're Muslims, but they're African, and so it's a bit of an ethnic. The underpinnings of the conflict in Sudan are complex. Are some religious underpinnings. The religious conflict in Nuba is less than it was in the previous conflict. But underlying all this is certainly has a racial note to it, where it's sort of African elite, Arab elite who have the power in Khartoum against the African tribes. So therefore, they're all Muslim, but the ones being targeted are the African tribes, therefore. And Nuba is the Nuba people who are African. Even though a lot of Nuba are Muslim, they are targeted by the Khartoum government. And I mean, so I think there's some element of racism. I mean, Omar Bashir, the president, will come out and say they want to get rid of they have to dispose of all the black plastic bags in the Blue Mountains. It's the president of the country who makes these outrageous statements. So I think the Nuba traditionally have been treated as second-class citizens up in Khartoum and the north. So I think, in a sense, the Khartoum government, there is a racial element. They want to rid the place of the African element. That's part of it. Another part of it is they want to drive these people further south, get rid of them, so that sort of more the Arab tribes in the north, maybe some of the pastoralists that have cattle, can move in, can use the Nuba Mountains, which has a good growing season. They can pasture the cattle there. They can grow crops. They can sort of take over that land and kick off the Nuba. And these Arab tribes will be more amenable, more agreeable to the Arab regime in Khartoum, whereas the African tribes are always in conflict with the Khartoum government because they're treated as second-class citizens. That's the main thing. So it has an ethnic and a racial character to it, the conflict.
So, I mean, one of the things that I've heard you say and I've found out from other people in my conversations and Nubians as well is that the Nuba people, I mean, majority may be Muslim, a lot are Christian, mm-hmm. many have their own traditional belief system that is thousands and thousands of years old, mm-hmm. traditional African belief system. But mm-hmm. within the Nuban people are very tolerant of one another's different kind of religious beliefs. You tell one story about a young man wearing a cross and saying his parents are Muslims, but he became a Christian. It was okay with them.
Right. Yeah, this in the Nuba Mountains, I think it might be the only place in the world. But there is literally complete racial harmony. I mean, I don't mean to sound like this utopian guy, but it's true. I mean, I can't say how many of my friends there. They'll have, I can tell you, one family just comes up my head. The father said, he was a Muslim. His wives were Muslim. Their oldest child is Muslim. The rest of the kids are Christian. But the Muslim son is married to a Christian lady, and those children are Christian. And nobody is bothered by any of this. Nobody gives the other person a problem. They say, you know, you're Muslim, you have your beliefs, and we're not going to give you a hard time. You guys want to be Christians? That's up to you. That's between you and God. You know, there's no reason to kill you or to subjugate you because you have a different belief. The Christians and Muslims in Nuba traditionally have no problem with each other. They even get together and they pray together. They'll have parties together. They're not bothered by this. And the same with the traditional beliefs. Nobody goes to those people and says, well, you're pagans, you know, you're not believers, you're bad people. They're just not bothered by it. They respect each other and what they believe. And this was one of the reasons why jihad against the Nuba was allowed in the 1990s. The Islamists in the north at that time could not tolerate the fact that the Muslims in the Nuba Mountains could associate with the Christians there. That was unacceptable to them. So another reason that they were allowed to kill Muslims, but these were not real Muslims. They associated with the Christians. They allowed them to practice the religion freely. This was not acceptable to the people in Khartoum.
So, in terms of your work, I find it interesting. You said earlier in our conversation that you're driven by your own belief in Christ and wanting to do good work in the world. But your own work in the Nuban Mountains, your own work in running this hospital, in being a healer, is not one for a missionary to convert, but a missionary, but as a physician to heal.
Right. So, I mean, you know, one of the problems with missionaries got so many negative connotations, and there's so much negative press against Christianity, against Catholicism in particular. I'm Roman Catholic, of course, and we're into the Catholic Diocese. The idea, my approach to being a missionary is not one of even preaching. I mean, certainly in terms of conversions, that is something between that person and God. I cannot force a conversion on somebody. What I can do is I can go to this place, I can show these people who are being terrorized that, hey, I'm a Christian, I believe in Jesus, that's why I'm here. Maybe they can see that, and maybe they see that as something good. Maybe they will take an interest in how I'm doing things. It's like I'm doing it covertly, but I'm saying, hey, this is what Christianity is about. Part of Christianity is doing what I'm doing. I don't see it as anything, you know, extraordinary. This is kind of what Christians are supposed to do. And if someone in Nuba finds that attractive, maybe they'd like to come and see what we're about. Or if they don't, they can at least see another face of Christianity. They can see what is Christianity? Yes, I mean, for me, Christianity is both the dogma, but also equally important is the action. One of the things quote off in the Bible is faith without works is dead, and meaning that you can have faith and talk and talk and talk, but if your actions don't back that up, then it's useless. And the way I see it is hopefully my end is the works part, and hopefully they can see what I'm doing and see it as an example of Christianity, as Christianity in action. That is my idea of what a missionary is. Simply put, it's not
right.
Fancy or not a lot of fancy words, just basically actions.
So Dr. Tom Catania, your hospital, it's called the Mother of Mercy Hospital, correct?
Yes.
That's in the Nuba Mountains. The way it's described to me by other people and the way you described it and some things I've seen you say and write is that there's always a constant danger that the hospital is going to be bombed. You're
yes.
always working to save people's lives, having to do amputations, the most horrendous cases.
Yes.
So, but you're going back.
And
this is the place that Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times, said he couldn't get to because it was too dangerous.
So. Well, yeah, I'll tell you, it's weird. When you're there and you're there every day, yeah, there is a risk. You hear the airplanes going overhead, you see them straight overhead, and you wonder, you know, at that moment you're wondering, well, is this the day they're gonna hit the hospital? They haven't yet. But everything there becomes normal. I mean, all this stuff, you know, it's kind of weird now because I'm sitting here and it's a nice day and I'm far away from there. It seems kind of strange, but when you're there, it becomes normal. I mean, you know, they bomb the place and they bring all these mangled bodies in and you do what you can. You don't see it as being that strange, you know, as strange as that may sound. It kind of takes on sort of a normal air. And, you know, what was once strange becomes normal. And then you just kind of adjust the situation. You see tremendous need. You see that without the services offered by the hospital, people would have absolutely nothing. When I'm there, I have no interest to leave. I have no interest to do anything else. I feel very, very comfortable in that situation. I feel that's exactly where I'm supposed to be. I don't feel like I've got to get out of here. I can't stand it. I mean, I'm content being there and doing that job as long as I'm needed and try to train some other guys to do the same work, and we can keep things going. Train some local guys to do the same work and keep going as long as possible.
And just a quick aside, in the couple minutes we have left, just before we talk about it, people can connect with you in the hospital. I mean, when you say mangled bodies are brought in, these are mangled bodies of not soldiers but civilians, of men and women and children who are tending their cattle, farming their fields, walking down the road.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's people in the market, the people at the collecting water, you know, walking exactly kids out in the fields with their cattle. They come in with arms blasted off. One elderly lady came in. She was about 65. This was a bombing a couple months ago. Two older ladies came in, both in the late 60s. One lady had 3 out of 4 of her limbs were shattered.
Oh, my
she
God.
She had one limb that was not busted. One leg was not broken. One other leg was shattered, and both her arms were just mangled. She did fine. She was really, incredible lady. Very cheerful, always had a smile on her face, and she's lying in bed in traction and with these casts and everything else. When you see that, you see the spirit of these people. Not a place you walk away from. You want to stay around and keep contributing that society.
So tell people. So now, when are you going back? And how do people connect with you in the hospital who want to follow the work and support it?
Right, I'm going back March 7th, till who knows when. I'm going back March 7th. You know, I'm there. I live there. So this was my first break for over a couple of years. We have internet. So I'm reachable by email. Not really phone. There's no phone service there. I mean, there's no way to call it by phone. But the way to reach me is by email. I can respond to those.
And how do we reach you by email? Tell us.
Oh, my email address is just my name, which is Tom Tom dot Catania, my second name. So Tom dot Catania, Tom dot Catania @gmail.com.
I'm only laughing, but at gmail.com, just, you know, so every day. So
that's right.
You know, so is there a website for the hospital and your work?
You know, there's not. When I was there just recently, I was starting to work on one. So hopefully, I hope to get one in the future. There is one for the diocese. It's what's it called Peter's Voice. Peter's Voice. I think it's petersvoice.com. But you look up Peter's Voice, P-E-T-E-R-S-V-O-I-C-E. Peter's Voice.
We will put all this contact information on our website, and I will write you back and forth over the coming months, too, just to stay in touch. And I appreciate, Tom Catena, the work you do, and thank you so much for taking your time today, and we'll have all the contact information on our website.
Great, Mark. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.